Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are on Daf Tet Vav Amud Aleph 15a. If you're following in the English, it's 15a1. And we begin with Avel Chayav Atifat Arash. A mourner is required to wrap the head. Okay? Now, just to remind you what we did toward the end of our last session, we discussed the symbolism of different types of burial. Remember, the particular burial that we were referring to was with a stone. And we entered into that. And part of my interest in doing that was to sensitize you to the symbolic nature of mourning practices. Sometimes the symbolic nature of a practice is quite evident. It comes out either in the scriptural text or in the Baraita, as that previous one did, where the placement of a big stone on the coffin of the menudeh, the person under a ban, was a form of rebuke and of humiliation. And we saw that stones were a form of humiliation. Nothing to do with a later custom of putting stones on a grave, which had to do rather with marking the grave. Simply, there was no way to mark graves. They didn't have the types of markers that we have. So that was the purpose of the stone. But in the Talmudic text, it's clear that the placement of stones was symbolic of the idea of stoning, which was a way of humiliating, a public sign of humiliation of the individual. Okay? So that's all last time. You can forget about that. I don't want to raise any new thoughts, but I just want to say this is where we concluded and where we take off from now. Now, the Mara at this point raises another type of practice. We're beginning to see a variety of different kinds of practice. We had seen about cutting the hair, that a mourner is prohibited to cut the hair. Remember that? Now we see another practice, Well, let's just see what it is first. Avel chayav atifat arosh. A person who is in mourning. Now, that doesn't mean an onen, remember. An onen was before the burial. After the burial, a person becomes a mourner, just at the point that the burial actually is completed. At that point, a person is a mourner. Avel, a mourner, is chayav atifat arosh, is required to wrap the head. Now, that's what it says. It required to wrap the head. Nidaka amar le'rachman li'yechezkel. Since it says in the Bible that the merciful one, Rachmana, God, told Ezekiel, velo ta'ata al safam. Do not veil yourselves, do not veil yourself al safam, literally on the lip. Do not veil yourself on the lip. Michlal dekuli alma michayve. Therefore, it follows that other people are required to veil themselves on the lip. To veil themselves on the lip. Okay? Now, let's just take this and think about it for a little bit. First of all, the statement here, as far as Ezekiel is concerned, Ezekiel is informed of the destruction of the temple. It's put in terms of the death of his wife. It's not an unusual way to do things, that a spouse becomes symbolic of the relation of God to the people of Israel. The husband and wife, God and the people of Israel. Okay? So the imagery is used here of the death of his spouse. It's clear that this is referring to the destruction of the temple, the destruction of the sovereignty. And it will be so terrible that in fact you will not even be able to mourn. That's the impact of it. That's the impact of it. So that normally you can at least mourn. There's a certain succor and relief that comes from the experience of mourning itself. But this will be so terrible that you won't even be able to mourn. Okay, so let's look at how he says it. Take a look at this sheet, although I think it's in the English here anyway. Take a look at my sheet about halfway down the page. It says Ezekiel 24:16-17. Vayehi devar Hashem elai le'mor. And the word of the Lord came to me saying. Okay? That's verse 15, 16. Ben Adam, man, hineni lokech mimcha et machmad einecha b'magefa. Behold, I am going to take from you the joy of your eyes with a plague. Right? Min is a double entendre there. It means both your wife, the symbolism is the wife, and then it means the temple, the state. Okay? Velotispot. That's the key thing. Velotispot. You will not be able to mourn. This bod eulogize. Velotifke. You'll be so upset you won't be able to weep. Velotavodimatecha. Your tear will not come from your eye. Heanek dom metim. Evel lo ta'ase. Heanek dom, you will be silent. Or the silence of death. Heanek dom, be silent, the silence of death. Evel lo ta'ase. Mourning you shall not do. Pe'ercha chavush alecha. Your beauty will be on your head. Your beauty will be on your head. Una'alecha tasim beraglecha. And shoes will be on your feet. Now, just to comment on these last two phrases. Pe'ercha. Pe'er, your beauty shall be on your head. The rabbis understood, and probably it may be the meaning of the verse directly. Pe'ercha means tefillin. Tefillin are called pe'er. The tefillah shel rosh is called pe'er, the beauty of the head. The beauty of the head. So reference may be made here that you shall wear your tefillin. And we will see, we'll get probably this later this evening to the custom of mourning not to wear the tefillin. Partly from this. Okay? You will wear your tefillin. You shall not mourn. You will be too upset to go through the normal phases of mourning. Michlal, from this you learn, you can abstract from that. The normal case is that you don't wear the tefillin. Okay? Una alecha tasim beraglecha. You will wear shoes. Okay? Therefore, the normal case of mourning, you do not wear shoes. Right? So we're learning from the biblical text in a strange way, in the opposite. And it's interesting, of course, the same thing happened when we learned last week about the Kohen. Remember, after the death of Nadav and Avihu, the Torah says, you shall not do this, you shall not do that. And from that we learn that you should do. What you should, what the normal case is, that you, what you should do. It's interesting that that's the way it's presented in the biblical text, and we learn from the negative, we learn a positive. Okay? V'lota'ate al safam. You shall not rap on the lip, or safam the mustache. Not clear exactly what it means. V'lechem anashim lo tochel. You shall not eat the bread of people. In other words, the mourner's meal will not come to you. Right? It is obligatory to serve the mourner, to give the mourner a meal. and the mourner's meal will not come to you. Now, among these things, one from the end, not the one before it is lo tate al safam. You shall not rap on the lip. You shall not rap on the lip. Okay? So this is apparently a custom of mourning. Rapping on the lip. Wrapping a garment somehow over the head or around the bottom of the face was considered in Talmudic times to be a requirement of mourning. Okay? Now, it's a very interesting thing. First of all, because we don't do it. And you may be familiar with the laws of mourning. We don't do anything like this. We simply don't do it. So whatever it means, we don't do it to begin with. So that in itself is interesting, because you might have thought that everything the Talmud says you're supposed to do, you know. After all, that's the Talmud. The Talmud says you're supposed to do it. So, and we don't do it. We don't do it. So that, to begin with, whatever it means, it's kind of interesting that we don't follow the law. Secondly, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean to wrap something around your lip? Does it mean to wrap something, let's say, from here up to the mustache? So that perhaps it means wearing a certain type of hat? Or does it mean wearing something, a scarf, around the neck? Okay? Well, let's take the first of the questions first, and I'll deal with the second of the questions second. Okay? First, why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? How could it be that we don't follow the law? Here, I brought for you the Shulchan Aruch. Reference is made to it in the notes. I want you to see the original, because it's rather a little bit fuller than the note. The Shulchan Aruch. Remember, the Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law, which is written in the 16th century in Tzfat by Rabbi Yosef Kara. And the Shulchan Aruch actually, in effect, is two books. If you take out a volume of the Shulchan Aruch, where's our Shulchan Aruch? That's back there. I just want you to even see it. Richard, behind you, bottom shelf, not next one over. Just take it off the shelf, any volume. I just want you to see how big it is. All right? Do you ever see a book that big? That's a volume of the Shulchan Aruch, published in a readable form. Some of it is so small you can hardly see it. It's a fascinating thing, the way a Shulchan Aruch is published, a full version of the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? As a Talmud, your main text is in the center. It's surrounded by commentaries. Okay? The laws of mourning are dealt with in the section of the Shulchan Aruch called Yoredeya. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch has four basic sections plus two sections, which some of you will remember I made a comment on Saturday late in the day. Right. Maybe I'll repeat it now, since you remember it so well, Terry. The Shulchan Aruch has four pillars. There are four pillars to the Shulchan Aruch. And it's the book of Rabbi Yosef Karo was a redoing of an earlier book called the Arba'a Turim, the four pillars, the Arba Turim. Okay? So the Arba Turim is the first of the major collections. Then Rabbi Yosef Karo redoes that, keeps the same structure, all the paragraphs are exactly the same, but he does it better. Okay? Arba Turim is about 150 years before. So it's called Arba Turim, four pillars. So I mentioned on late Saturday afternoon that one of the great rabbis was still alive.
Rabbi's last test before he got married.
Right.
Correct. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who some of you may know. Rabbi Rachman is today probably 96 or so. He's lived to a ripe old age. Thank God he was the...
Used to be at Fifth Avenue Synagogue.
Used to be the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. He was the chancellor of Bar Ilan University. Amazing, absolutely amazing rabbi of our time. And we had the pleasure of being close to him. He was Naomi's rabbi growing up, and he was the rabbi who married us. So, that way, at the time, he was the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and we were not married there. We were married in Far Rockaway, where he had been previously. So he said to me, you know, I was then a rabbinical student. He said, I want you to know, you know, that you have to keep all the six pillars of the Shulchan Aruch. So here I am listening to him. He's a great rabbi, and made a mistake. And I'm gonna say you made a mistake. So I smile, you know. You figure either something's going on here. I guess I'm dumb. I mean, I thought it was four, it must be six. What do I know? I'm only a rabbinical student. He's a great rabbi. So he goes on with this for a little while, and then there's a twinkle in his eye, and he says, you know what the six pillars are. And he says, Orech Chaim and Yored Dayan, Choshen Mishpat, and so on. The four that you know, okay? And then he says, and there are, of course, two more. I said, really? Now I knew that, you know, we were onto something. And he knew exactly what he was doing, and I wasn't as dumb as I thought I was, too. There were, in fact, four. So he says, and of course, there are two more. I said, oh, yes. He says, Sechel and Derech Eretz. Which is to say that in the application of a law, you have to use your head. Don't be stupid. Which is the way in which a lot of things are frequently rendered, is without any sechel. And derech eretz, you have to have decency toward your fellow human being, and you have to know how to be a nice guy.
Good manners.
Good manners, to say the least. To say the least. You have to take into consideration people's feelings and who they are. So the Shulchan Aruch, even in its original written form, toward the end of the 16th century, when Rabbi Yosef Kara wrote it, remember, he was a Sephardi rabbi. He was a Sephardi rabbi living in Sfat. And by that time, the Sephardi customs had already, there was a very significant period of time had already passed, and there was a significant difference between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. So that when the Ashkenazi rabbis in Europe began to get the text of the Shulchan Aruch, because it was a welcome text, it was a very useful compilation and summary of the law, which was very valuable, particularly in the 16th century. They really needed that. So the rabbis noticed, of course, that in numerous areas there would be a differing custom among the Ashkenazim to the Sephardim. So soon after, it must have been within about 10 years after the publication of the Shulchan Aruch in Sfat, in about 1560, and of course, I don't know how it was done then. These were the early days of the printing press, so maybe it was printed in an actual printing press. I don't know what the state of printing was in that part of the world at that time. But it got to Europe. And Rabbi Moshe Isserles of Krakow wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which added the Ashkenazi customs. So Shulchan Aruch means literally in Hebrew, you know what it means?
Set table,
Shulchan Aruch. Everything is set. All you have to do is eat. That was the idea. He set the table so that you could come and eat. You didn't have to read the whole Talmud. Read the whole Talmud, you never know what you're doing. You know that. It's the nature of Talmud. So better he should come and give you a set table so that when you wanted to eat, you'd be able to eat. So Rabbi Moshe Isserles wrote the Ashkenazi emendations, which he called the Mapa. A Mapa on a table is a tablecloth. He put it, he said the table didn't have a cloth on it. So he had to put the tablecloth, because it was our custom to always cover our tables with a tablecloth. Okay? So the Rama put the tablecloth on the table. Now, I bring that to your attention because that will be relevant when we read the law here. Shulchan Aruch, Yoredea, Siman, Shin Pei Vav. Right. Literally, Atifat Arosh is wrapping the head. Wrapping the head. This is Yoredea. Siman Shin Pei Vav. Shin is 300. Pei is 80. Vav is 6. So 386. Okay? So it's paragraph Siman, sign, literally, but it's not actually a paragraph. It's a section. Section 386. Seif Aleph.
Are they numbered in the Shulchan Aruch?
Yes, as this. They're not numbered in Hebrew letters. It's all, this is directly from the Shulchan Aruch. Se'if Aleph, paragraph 1. Chayav pa'atifat arosh. It is required that a mourner wrap the head. Wrap the head. Dahainu shi'chase rosho b'talit. Which is to say that he should cover his head with a talit. Now, I don't know what a talit means there. A talit doesn't necessarily mean what it means to you and me. Because in the Talmud, for example, talit means a garment. It doesn't mean a talis. It means a garment. So I don't know whether to him it means a talit or it means a garment. It could be either. O bisudar. A sudar is a turban. A turban of some kind. Excuse me?
Scarf.
A scarf. Well, a turban is a wrapped scarf. Right? A scarf that's wrapped up. The yachazir ketzato al piv. And he shall make part of it pass over his mouth. Va'al rosh hachotem. And on the tip of the nose. So here, my sense is that maybe you start out with something here, with a scarf that starts wrapped like that, leaves place for the eyes, and then comes over like that, and then drapes. Okay?
Like Lawrence of Arabia in that movie.
Well, like Lawrence, who else dresses like that?
Or a bandage.
Who else dresses like that? Lawrence of Arabia dressed like
Arabs.
Arabs, keep this in mind. That this is, in our mind, Arab dress. This may be dress that is similar to a kafia, that the Arabs wear, although my own sense is that, you know, I haven't seen people put the kafia, well, you do in these Hamas pictures, you know, the
ninjas.
The ninjas. Ninjas I don't know as well as Hamas.
In a sandstorm.
Uh-huh.
That's why you do it in the first place.
Uh-huh.
In a sandstorm.
You wrap it over.
To not breathe in all the dust.
Uh-huh,
that's
very good.
It's more like women in Florida.
It's not
right,
for
it's more like modesty.
Uh-huh. That's well, maybe that's your, well, but yes, but this is not, as far as we know, referring to women.
Women,
of course. And there's no issue of modesty that
right.
seems to be brought
no,
up.
In terms
here.
Of what it resembles.
Uh-huh.
And
also
anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Yes. All right, keep this in mind. You're hidden behind something. You're hidden behind. Okay?
And does it apply only to men?
It's not clear.
Okay.
It's not at all clear. Not clear who it applies to, since we don't even observe it. Okay? Okay? V'hani mili shetzarich atifa b'chol hayom. And these words which say that you have to have a wrapping b'chol hayom, throughout the day. Aval, but kishebaim menachamim etzlo, when visitors come to pay a shivakol, migale rosho lichvodam, he uncovers his head for their honor. Okay, so very interesting. Exactly, exactly. So it's really kind of, my sense was that you would do it in order to hide yourself from the visitors in a way, to give you protection from them.
You run to the other room to get your little fuzzy slippers.
Okay. But here he says that you don't have to do it. No. I'm sorry, that you undo it when the people come in. Then it says hege. Hege mal he. Hey Gimel Hey is the introduction to the Rama. This is the Mappa one I'm going to read. Okay, so now we're going to read an Ashkenazi comment, the Rama of Krakow, on what we just read from Tzvat. V'yesh omrim, there are those who say, she'ein noagim b'midinot elu ba'atifa, that there are those who say that it is not the custom in these countries to do the wrapping. All right? And then he goes on, it's just a quote there. Excuse me? Midinot Elo is referring to the whole Ashkenazi world. Okay? Ashkenaz not being a specific place, because Ashkenaz can mean different things. It doesn't mean Germany, for example. He's in Krakow. Okay, so he's talking to the Ashkenazi custom is not to do that. The chen aminhag pashut, and this, in fact, the custom is widespread. The ein lahachmir, and we should not be stringent. Lishanot b'meshalo nahagu avotenu, we should not be more stringent in requiring things that our own fathers did not require. In other words, you may say that since the Talmud says and since Rabbi Yosef Karo says that you're supposed to cover the face, right, supposed to wrap it, that we should do that too. But he's saying it's not our custom. It wasn't our father's custom. And who are we to say that our fathers were not observant? Okay, our fathers were at least as observant as we are, and therefore we have to respectfully do whatever they did. Right? It's fascinating. And of course, respectfully doing what they did is not what Rabbi Yosef Karo did, and it's not what the Shulchan Aruch says, and it's not what the Talmud says. But it is, in fact, what is the law. So, in fact, that is the law. And it finally spreads throughout the Jewish world, as far as I know. I do not believe that the Sephardim follow this law either. Now, the Shach, there are in Yoredeya, there are commentaries on the Yoredeya itself, which you saw, Richard just opened the book, you saw that massive commentaries around. One of the most respectable of the commentaries is that of the Shach, who is a rabbi, Rabbi Shabtai ben Meir HaKohen. Shach means, he wrote a book called Siftei Kohen, The Lips of the Kohen, because he was a Kohen. So this was his teaching. So he called it Siftei Kohen. And it fit also because he was Shabtai HaKohen. Shin Chaf. The name of the commentary is known, therefore, as the Shach. The Shach lived in Vilna in the middle of the 17th century. Okay? So middle of the 17th century, we're almost 100 years later now. He's now commenting on what the Rabbi Moshe Isserles of Krakow said almost 100 years before. It's about 75 years before. Okay, because actually the Shach, his Siftei Kohen was one of his earlier books, so he must have written this by 1650 or so. Okay, so less than 100 years. He writes the following. This is my second thing. It's Shach Yoredeya Simon Shin Pei Zivav Aleph. V'yesh omrim she'ein noagim. Here he quotes the Rama. It's a quote of the Rama. And he gives the reason. Mipnei she'mevi liyedei schok gadol. Because such a custom will lead to great ridicule. Min ovdei kochavim, from the Gentiles, ve'avadim u'shfachot, from the male and female servants. Here again, an insight into Jewish life in Lithuania. Obviously, they employed Gentile servants, and the Gentile servants would see the Jews walked around like zombies. Okay, they wrapped up their faces and they were like, would have been like ghosts, which would have led, he said, to ridicule among the Gentiles. Okay, kochavim v'avadim u'shfachot shebeinenu. Mihu, however, yesh linhog ba'atifa ketzat. He says, however, one should do a little bit of this wrapping, sort of symbolic wrapping, dehainu, which is to say, limshoch hakova lamata, to pull the head down a little low, not the head, the hat, to pull a hat down a little low, lifnei ha'enayim, down to the level of the eyes, v'chein mashma bevayet chadash v'ayen l'kaman siman taf. And that is what comes to be accepted in his community. So, in other words, they substituted what is probably a different custom because it was more socially acceptable.
Did you move your hat up again when people came to visit?
That's unknown. Unknown.
And why? Who would have seen you? I mean, right. You're sitting at home all wrapped up, and you're getting unwrapped if your friends come over. So who are these strangers who are going to see you?
The servants.
Or just the servants.
The servants in the house. Well, both the servants in the house. You have to keep in mind, we think that Jews didn't have close relations with Gentiles. It's not true. The Shach, for example, had a very close friend who was a Christian Renaissance writer, who was a philosopher and a scientist. And they and the Shach developed, this fellow and the Shach developed a close intellectual relationship between them. And they would complement each other in their writings. So, I mean, interestingly enough, you know, we think of this absolute separation of the Jews from the Gentiles. It wasn't like that. It was not easy. Shach, for example, I said to you that he lived in the 17th century. He dies in 1662. In 1648, do you know what happened in 1648? The Chmelnytsky pogroms happened in 1648. As a result of the pogroms of Chmelnytsky, which was further into Russia, also there is a fallout right through into Lithuania. And essentially, he has to get out of town. He ends up as a rabbi in Moravia. So he had to go far. He ended up in Moravia, essentially in Czechoslovakia, where he was a rabbi then, finally died in Moravia. I believe he's buried in Moravia and not in Vilna, where he wrote. Okay, all that was because of the fallout of the Chmelnytsky pogroms in 1648. Right? So on the one hand, the situation of the Jews was terrible. On the other hand, the reality is that Jews had relations with Gentiles. And intellectual figures like the Shach had intellectual relations with prominent Gentiles. Okay, so there could have been people like that who were involved. And of course, the ones that he points to here are the household servants.
But there are plenty of things that Jews do that would seem strange. A whole method of prayer with tefillin,
somebody should write a book on, you know, on the one hand you're absolutely right, but of course you're absolutely wrong, because Jews, you're right, all of these things could be considered crazy, but the fact is they're not all considered crazy. Sometimes some things are considered crazy, sometimes other things are considered crazy. You know, they're each time in its fashions, without a doubt. And my major interest in this is not to say the Shach is right, but to just give you, you can see from this kind of commentary, gives you insight into the social nature of Jewish conventions and the way in which people, in fact, are sensitive to these things, whatever it is, and however they decide it. Each to his own time, and people make their own decisions in their own times. You take so many of the things in our own day, the wearing of the yarmulke. When I was a rabbinical student, nobody wore a yarmulke. Nobody wore a yarmulke. It just wasn't done. You would never do it. Tzitzit out. I myself was in the Lubavitch Yeshiva. I was in Lubavitch. I spent some time in Lubavitch here on Eastern Parkway. And I remember one of the rabbis giving us a lesson, saying that Lubavitch Rebbe says that when it says, Uri'item otam, you shall see them, it means you yourself shall see them, not the other person. And therefore you should wear your tzitzis inside and not outside. So that was always my practice. That still is my practice. So then I had to wear it inside and not outside. I come from that generation. So then I remember I had a student in the seminar. I started teaching in the seminar. I would start teaching in the summers. So all these wacky guys come out of conservative synagogues and reform congregations. They got to the seminar, they get religious. They want to see what religion is all about. What do they start doing? To my chagrin, first of all, they start wearing yarmulkes. All over the place. I mean, we're not talking about when they study, we're talking about everywhere. They start wearing yarmulkes. I feel, what is the world coming to? then that was just the beginning. They start wearing their tzitzis out. Nobody in those days wore tzitzis out. Well, maybe some people, even Hasidim didn't wear tzitzis out. It just wasn't done. You didn't do things like that. So these guys start wearing tzitzis out. I couldn't believe it. I happened to meet up with this one guy who was in my class. I was visiting in Ohio. He turned out to be a rabbi in Ohio, this guy. So as soon as I saw him, I said, I got to see if his tzitzis are still out. It turned out he's a reform rabbi. The guy went to reform rabbinic. He went to the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. His tzitzis went not out. I'm sure he's wearing tzitzis, but I'm not really sure. How can I know? I don't want to embarrass him. I want to say, you know, when you were a kid, I remember you used to wear tzitzis on Broadway. But all of these things, what in one generation is considered to be bizarre, could be de rigueur in the next. Believe me, all of these things have undergone in my short lifetime such changes. I surely would never predict it. It's impossible to predict.
How is it that Ovdei Kochavim means Gentiles?
That's a very interesting thing. Ovdei Kochavim means Gentiles because that was in all likelihood substituted by the Gentiles for what was really there. This is a censor's word, the word Ovdei Kochavim. It was not originally there. What in all likelihood it said was goyim.
But what a euphemism is that, Ovdei Kochavim?
Ovdei Kochavim means idolaters. Idolaters who worship the stars.
Oh, that's considered idolaters. Worship
the stars. Yeah, worshiping of the stars, correct. So in all likelihood, the Gentile censors censored the text that we have, and this text is still not, didn't go through resurrection to get rid of all of those things, which is what's happening to Jewish texts these days, by the way. You'll read some texts which say Ovdei Kochavim, you'll know that they still have the censored cool. text. When they're published in Israel today, usually they make an effort to change all of those things back to their original form. It's the first time in 500 years.
I just studied this last night in MIA class, that about the 13th century when they had this argument and they started recognizing that the Talmud had things in it that were not acceptable to Christianity. And that's what made troubles for us.
Talmud's always been a problem.
and that's when they started editing out things from the Talmud.
The real problem came, I don't know whether you studied this last night, but from Jews who converted to Christianity.
Yes,
that was the problem. Because the Christians basically, as you could imagine, what kind of Christian would ever read this kind of material? You got to be crazy to read this. I mean, the kind of labor intensive life that this requires, you got to be Jewish to do this. I mean, only Jews are able to do this.
My sister sent me an email today. My sister's daughter has a celiac disease and can't eat wheat. And as a result, my sister has become involved in these online communities of people who share information. There's a Catholic woman who wanted to know the source by which we know that matzot can be made from oats, because she is arguing with the Catholic Church. She wants her daughter to be able to take communion with wafers made from oats. I explained.
It's the information age, really.
But I mean, but I sent it back to my sister. I said, you know, they don't rely on halakha when they make their decisions at the Vatican. This is, she's trying to use this exact same sort of reason.
Yes,
bolstering her
undoubtedly.
I would like to refer to the reason for covering your lips or your mouth for the mourner. And it is, may of course be a crazy speculation, but there was a reference in one of the things that we learned that the mourner is tempted to curse even God. So to prevent the lips from speaking badly, they may have instituted that as a symbol to keep, colloquially speaking, a mouth shut.
It's a nice thought. It's a nice thought. It'd be great to have some textual evidence for it, of which there's none.
That's your job.
I'll look. I want to go a little bit further and then come back to this, because I just want you to see the... Because now I've dealt with... I had two questions. First question was, how could this be required? We don't do it. So I've taken care of that to the extent that I can. Next question is, what is meant by this? Okay, what is meant in terms of the detail of what is meant? And then let's see what its potential symbolic meaning is, which is what you're opining on now, what its symbolic meaning can be. I think that to see that, it helps to go a little bit further. The Gemara then, remember now, the Gemara is dealing with three categories, hold on a second, three categories together. The Avel, the Menudeh, and the Tzarua. Right? The mourner, the person under a ban, and the person with leprosy. I use that word leprosy, whatever it means. Okay? So the Gemara now says, Menudeh, mahu ba'atifat arosh. Right? Is the person under a ban required likewise to cover the head, to wrap the head? I'll just translate it, wrap the head. Okay? Amar Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, Tashma, come and learn. Tashma is usually the introduction to a Braita. Okay? And the Braita here deals with a case of if there has been a long period without rain. Right? The rabbis are told to institute communal fasts. You fast for lack of rain in the land of Israel. This refers to the land of Israel. Okay? And if, so you fast once, you do a communal fast, and then ideally the rain comes. Doesn't come, you fast again. Doesn't come, you fast again. It's a whole series of fasts here. So then this Baraita talks about, well, after 13 fasts, right, very difficult period of famine, obviously, it now becomes necessary for the rabbis, hen mit atfin v'yoshvin kiminudin ucha'avelim. They wrap themselves and sit like minudim, people under a ban, and like mourners. Now the key word there was mit'atfim. Mit'atfim. Wrap themselves. They wrap themselves. Okay? Ad shiyirachamu aleihem min hashamayim. Until God has mercy upon them. So in other words, this, after no success in fasting, then one really begins to go to another level, almost of asceticism, of persecuting oneself and acting like a mourner or somebody under a ban, because obviously God is not listening. God, who is the rabbi, has decided to put you off. That is a condition then of the people being menudim. The people are under a ban, obviously, and God has placed them under a ban. And therefore the people act, they wrap themselves like menudim. Okay? Then the Gemara, however, says, so this seems to be a proof that a menuder wraps himself, wraps his head the way a mourner does. But then the Gemara says, Amale Abaye, Dilmi menuder l'shamayim shane. Maybe someone who is under a ban to heaven is in a different case. All right? After all, God was the one, he was the rabbi putting you into a ban. When God is the rabbi, it's more serious. So you can't necessarily learn from what God does and your reaction to God, the relations between human beings. Human rabbi and a human congregant is different than the divine rabbi and the human congregant. Okay? Munele Shamayim Shani Dechamir. It's a more stringent situation. It's more difficult. Okay? So, interestingly enough, the Gemara here does not come to any conclusion. We don't really learn whether the Minudeh wraps himself or not. Last one is, the next one which you would have to cover is then the Metzorah. Right? We need to know the law of the Metzorah. Mahu ba'atifat arosh. What is the law of the Metzorah as far as wrapping the head goes? Tashma. Come in here. Again, a baraita. Va'al safam yateh. In the Torah itself, the Torah itself says in Leviticus 13:45, in describing the things that a Metzorah has to do, it says specifically, al safam yateh, he shall wrap on the lip. He shall wrap on the lip. It's a slightly different word. It's ayin tet hey, as opposed to le ayin tet fei, but they both mean wrap. They both mean wrap. So there it says, michlal shechayav ba'atifat arosh. We derive from that biblical verse, it seems to say quite clearly, that the tsarua, the person who has leprosy, is required to wrap the head. And then the Gemara says, shmamina. That is, in fact, a decisive proof. Okay? So here we have two cases where it's clear that there is a required wrapping. The third case is not clear. We don't really know what the case of the menudeh is. We don't know how that turns out. The Gemara just doesn't give us any more. It doesn't give us any more evidence. Doesn't continue the conversation. Okay. Now, just some further thoughts on what is meant here, atifat arosh. Interestingly enough, if you think about it, you actually know something about this. Where do you know the word atifa from?
Talit.
Which word?
Talit. How do you know from the talit?
No, le'etatef betalit.
Le'etatef, not betalit.
Oh, betzitzit.
Betzitzit. Le'etatef betzitzit, right. The bracha for putting on a talit is the only case now where you have lehit atef used in the language of a bracha. Okay? Therefore, I want you to see some of the laws of putting on the talit. If we see the laws of putting on the talit, maybe we'll come to understand a little bit more about what this is. Okay? In the classic collection of halacha called Trumat HaDeshen, he has a section here where he discusses how to put on a talit. How to put on a talit. And he says, the ba'oto derech, I'll go back a little, nir'eh delitlot ha-talit biretzu'ah. He says, it would appear that to hang the talit just like a ritzu'ah. How do you say ritzu'ah?
Strap.
Like a strap. Lav shapir dame. Lo tofu. In other words, I don't know whether you grew up in synagogues where the talit was simply worn, like a shawl. It was the shawl talit. The shawl talit.
Thin one.
So the question is, if you say the bracha, and you then simply place the shawl on your shoulders, have you done what you said in the bracha? The bracha says, lehit atef betzitzit, He says, you have not done it. The ituf bechol dichtin, because where the word ayin tet fe is used, bechol dichtin, that means bechol makom, in every place, mashma atifata rosh. The meaning is wrapping the head. As we have, the Gemara says, it's atifata rosh. It's called wrapping of the head that we're reading about mourning. Therefore, in putting on the talit, you must wrap the head and not the body. When you say the bracha, you have to wrap the head and not the body. Uve mi mehem hayu regilim bichsuta mechase arosh v'haguf. He says, in their day, in the days of the Talmud, they were accustomed to wearing a covering which covered both the head and the body. Right? Sort of, I guess, a togers, or else this is referring to the, what were you referring to before? The kafiyah. Maybe something that wraps the head but also continues onto the body. Kedi amar talicha hakatan mikasebo roshova rubo. Such as, for example, in the Talmud, it talks about a miner covering himself with a talit which covers his head and most of him. So it's one garment then that was wrapped around both the head and the body. The gadol yotze ba'aray chayav betzitzit de'lachach tiknu. Therefore, they made the law levarech lehitatef betzitzit. To say the blessing, to wrap oneself as in the tzitzit. Aval ksut she'eino mechase harosh, but a covering which does not cover the head. Li'olam ein livarech alav lehitatef. You are never allowed to make a blessing lehitatef. Okay? Therefore, you have the custom of when you put on the talit, not to put it on the shoulders, but to put it on the head. Because the word lihitatef refers always to a wrapping of the head.
Okay? Let's attempt to close it over the lips too.
That's correct. But now I want to read you, just so you see, before you do this too much, I want to read you the comments of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. I told you before that Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is the greatest living halachist. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is the top of all of the living halachists. He is the called the Rishon LeZion. I heard him on the radio a week and a half ago. I heard him on the radio. That's great the way they treat their rabbis.
I'm sure Howard Stern would love to have you come on to the radio show.
His halachic writing is unbelievable. It is so brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. Nobody writes the way he does, both in terms of the clarity of the Hebrew and in terms of the incisiveness of his insight. He just knows so much that he brings to bear on a particular subject.
You ought to stick to it.
Well, that's true. That's a problem with rabbis, you know. That the world becomes their pulpit. Okay. He has a whole section here. Let me just see if I can start in a place where Zetamoamod. He describes something that is very, very amazing, very odd. Shaharei bevadai ech zo atifata yishmelim. In fact, atifa comes in the halachic literature to be called atifata yishmelim, namely the way Arabs wrap themselves. And that is considered to be a standard then. It's the kafir that becomes the standard of how to put on the talit. Would you believe it? Don't tell anybody beyond this room. Okay? All right. Sha'arei bivadai ein zo atifata yishmaelim kasher einenu haro'ot. Our eyes see this. We live among Ishmaelites. We live with Arabs. And we know what the practice is of how they wrap their kafiyas. She'ilu ayu mechasim einehem. The problem he's arguing against is that people put on their talit, and they say the way to put it on is to simply wrap completely over the face. So he said that's not the way to do it. He's arguing against it. Ashkenazi custom is to do that. It is to do it. He's arguing against that custom. And listen how he argues. She'ilu ayu mechasim enehem lo ayu motzim yedehem v'raglehem belechtam. He says, if the Arabs would cover their eyes the way Jews cover their eyes when they wrap themselves in the talit, an Arab wouldn't be able to know where his feet were going and he would trip on himself. So he says, since the law is you're supposed to do it the way the Yishmaelim do it, the Arabs surely don't cover their eyes. Nobody can cover their eyes because they can't see where you're going if you cover your eyes. Okay? Ela pashut. Rather, obviously. Kavanata ga'on Rabbi Zalman. Shiasima talit al rosho. That a person, Zalman, this is Rabbi Zalman Auerbach, one of the great Israeli poskim, who's dead now, he died a number of years ago. He says, "Shiasim, you should put the talit on the head. V'achar kach yashlich letzad hayamin shel talit al ketefo asmolit. You've seen people do this. They throw one side over one shoulder. They throw the other side over the other shoulder. Okay, like that. You mean the talit al ketefo asmolit? Ba'ofen shiyes saviv chalkat savaro, so that it goes around your neck." So that it goes around your neck, ad shiyechase et chelak hatachton shel hapanim, until it covers the lower part of the face. Okay, not the upper part, but the lower part of it. Dahainu zikano usantero ad peiv, which is to say the beard and the chin until the mouth. Vizohi atifat hayishmaelim. That is the way the Arabs cover themselves. V'rayala zem yoredeya. The proof of this is from Yoredeya, Shin Siman Shin Pei Vav, which is what we just read. Okay. Ulefele sherabim toim bezeh ve'ein mishim chebi adam. He says it's amazing that everybody makes this mistake and nobody says anything. He's a very outspoken kind of a guy. Here he says, "Ubesefer nimukei orachayim aneamar leel hevin divrei shulchan aruch ha'gaon Rabbi Zalman." They mistakenly think of the comments of Rabbi Zalman to mean sheyechaseh chelak ha'elyon shel apanim ad lamata mipif, that you should cover the upper part of the face until the bottom of the mouth. Vitama alav. That's ridiculous. Sharei yesh rayot brurot she'en lasot kein. There are obvious proofs that you shouldn't do it that way. Okay? Kamosha reperesh l'nechon ha'gaon Rabbi Avraham Chaim and so on. Vayen od b'meiri moed katan b'dibur v'al chayav ba'atifat harosh. You are required, in the Shulchan Aruch, what we read, you're required to wrap the head. And there it means covering the head. Vagam halom ra'iti la rava ga'on Rabbi Moshe Stern, Be'er Moshe Chem, Sheherich litmoa ala noagim lechasot apanim ve'inayim. It's another rabbi who also rightly wrote lengthily to question those who cover their face and their eyes when they wrap themselves in the talit. Sheminhag ze ta'ut gamur. This such a custom is a complete mistake. Ki lo ya'ale al da'at ha'yishmaelim mitadfim ba'ofen kazeh. No Arab would ever do anything like that. Okay, I think that proves the point.
I ran into that recently online when I was looking for a substitute source for the website about legging tefillin. And I ran into this at the Chabad website, and I had never seen this. I assumed it had Kabbalistic significance over the left side and the right side. I didn't realize it comes all back to this.
This is the source of it. This is the source. I'm sure that you could give Kabbalistic significance to brushing your teeth. which, of course, is a Kabbalistic, definitely is done for Kabbalistic reasons.
And according to Rabbi Obadiah, this element, the source of this element are the Arabs. But the fact is that prior to Muhammad, the Arabs were pagans.
Don't make any difference. The Arabs are in the Talmud. And they're called the Arabi. They're referring to
the evening.
Probably. But the Bedouins, they probably refer to Bedouins, or there always were Arabs. They were not Muslims, but there were Arabs.
Yeah, but they had the head wrapping, as that lady pointed out, because of the sandstorms. That was the real reason originally.
So that's exactly it. I assume that these head coverings go way back. Now, just to take this one step further, I think that the truth is that we really don't know what is being referred to here. I think that it would be an interesting piece of research to keep this in mind, for example, particularly when you look at if there are any sources, but to keep in mind in looking at Hellenistic Greek art, if we could find, for example, the types of head wrappings that were used in the Middle East in roughly the Talmudic period here, I think that you might find that in Greek art, possibly. Some of this, of course, goes back much further, because the portion that we read about the tsarua having to wrap, that, you remember, last time I think it was that we spoke about that was Barry Kohler was contending that was for hygienic purposes, that if you cover the mouth, in effect, that is a sort of a basic, very primitive way of stopping the communication of disease, and that perhaps that was what was meant by it. It could be. Excuse me, but here you can see that what goes on is that you have several different paradigms. Both the menuda and the tsarua and the avel, who are treated quite similarly. And at least in the Talmudic context, to the extent that there is symbolism involved, I think the most obvious level of symbolism would probably come out of a comparison of those three categories of people. Okay? And I think we should think about that a little bit. You know, what is the purpose of mourning customs? What is the purpose of a custom like this? I think you began to comment on it in a way that I think is important in terms of separation. There's a sense of separation.
Or differentiation.
Differentiation. There's something of that. You're going
to
comment on
that? Yeah, I want to say something. I remember after 9/11, they had an interview with bin Laden on television, and it looked like he was unwrapping like ace bandages from his head. I don't know if anyone else remembers that. He was wearing that kind of thing on his head.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something, a clue in what you said earlier about the meaning being banned from the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this whole combination of menudeh, metzorah, and avel all combined is being banned from the grace of God.
I mean, that's very important. You know, when we think of the purpose of our mourning customs, because we are so psychologically learned, we really are seeing all of this in terms of modern psychology. We are thinking about comforting others. And there's surely a dimension in the laws of mourning, which is clearly that, nichum avelim, the Talmud says, just comforting the mourner. It's a little hard to see how wrapping the head is comforting. Maybe. But I wanted to introduce yet another category that I think should come into our response to these different symbols. And it hold on just a second. It fits together with the lecture that we heard last Friday night, which was a lecture on Rabbi Soloveitchik. Soloveitchik wrote a very, what I think is a very significant article on the laws of mourning. It's generally not very well known. It was published a number of years ago in a collection called Jewish Reflections on Death. And as far as I know, this has gone out of print, and the article has gone out of print too. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, who died, I don't know how many years Soloveitchik is dead, probably 10 years, well, not much more than that. Soloveitchik lived in Boston. He wrote a fair amount on death after the death of his wife. When the Rebbetzin died, Tanya Soloveitchik, he was bereft when his wife died. And he wrote some of what I consider to be some of his most interesting writing after the death of his wife. He writes about the customs of mourning in a way that I think is a little bit different than we will normally think of the customs of mourning. There's a section here called tshuva, repentance. Question arises, what is the experiential substance of avelut mourning? In the second phase means shiva, as opposed to aninut, before the burial. The latter is intrinsically an experience of tshuva, of repentance. The aching heart is a contrite heart, and a contrite heart is, of course, an atoning heart. Enlightened avelut contains a feeling of guilt. Now, this is something we moderns never talk about. You know, pre-moderns, Freudians talked about this. Freudians talked about the nature of guilt in death. But we don't talk about that anymore, because all we think about is being good and kind and loving. But if you read Freud and Freud's writings on death, it's all about guilt. People feel tremendous guilt when a loved one dies. And that, Soloveitchik writes, is at the heart of many of the laws of mourning, is an intense feeling of guilt. In fact, the laws concerning the observance of Shiva express not only a mood of grieving, but also, and perhaps mainly, a mood of repenting. Repenting. That's the binudeh.
Yeah,
that is the minudeh, who is somebody who is under a ban, right? Mm-hmm. Who is being forced into a position of repentance, all right? He feels alienated from the community, all right? There's an effort to induce in him feelings of guilt so that he will repent. Quite a few of the injunctions governing the observance of Shiva, such as the prohibitions against washing, the use of cosmetics, ointments, wearing shoes, sex life, are reminiscent of Yom Kippur. Somehow, we arrive at a strange equation. The act of mourning equals the act of expiation. Very interesting. I think there's a profound thought here. The act of mourning equals the act of expiation. Not the way we normally think about this. The halacha demands the mourner to expiate his guilt by observing those prescribed rites which are also observed on the holy day of atonement when the man is questing for forgiveness. What is the feeling of guilt which is implied in avilot and with which the halacha is concerned? First, death per se is a consequence of sin or human imperfection. If man were perfect, if the ultimate law, moral law were within his reach, there's a good Orthodox rabbi here, If he had not fallen away from his maker, men would could combat death. As a matter of fact, we do believe that in the eschatological world, where man will attain absolute perfection, death will finally be defeated. The equation of mourning and repentance is expressed in a passage in Moed Katan. This is just beyond where we are now, next Amud. A mourner is bound to overturn his couch, because Bar Kappara taught, God says, I have set the likeness of my image in them, and through their sins have I upset it. Let your couches be overturned on account of this. The passage becomes intelligible if we take into consideration that according to Talmudic and Midrashic symbolic semantics, the term mitah, couch or bed, represents man as father and teacher, as link between past and future, both at a natural and a spiritual level. If man fails to discharge his twofold duty, his image is tarnished and death follows. The overturned couch represents a desecrated image of man, and the mourning rites represent an act of expiation. Second, the aspect of guilt is interwoven into the human time consciousness. Man is a tragic as well as a comical figure in a variety of ways. However, his peculiar way of forming value judgments is the saddest of all his experiences, and at the same time the most ludicrous of all his comical performances. Man is always a latecomer as far as the formation of value judgments is concerned. His axiology or appreciation of persons, things, and events is always a product of hindsight. This is what he is saying. He is saying, essentially, you really don't know what it is to love your loved one until they die. And the minute you realize that, you realize how absolutely terrible that is. And that is a terrible, tragic reality of the human condition. Okay? In retrospection, man discovers the precise value of something which, or somebody who, was but is no longer with us. This kind of tardiness in understanding and appreciating is tragic as well as comical. While the somebody was near, while I could communicate with the somebody, I was unaware of him as if he were nobody. He comes into existence and turns into somebody important and precious at the very moment he departs from me and is lost in the mist of remoteness. Only after he is gone do I begin to ask, who was he? What did he mean to me? All these questions which descend in droves upon the grieving, expiating individual are extremely painful, since they are saturated with a feeling of guilt. One torturing, cruel question stands out. Why didn't I ask all these questions yesterday while the somebody was still here? Okay? So that's Soloveitchik's reading, then, of the symbolism. We have to keep in mind that an essential idea behind the symbolism here is probably symbolisms of guilt. Because the experience of mourning is so profoundly connected to some of the necessary existential guilts that, in fact, we will need to expiate as part of our ability to go on. Okay, that's what I wanted to say.
I think there's also just a sense of fear on the part of people who are around others who have suffered a loss, and to some extent that is logical to me only in the sense of why this person, why the mourners would remain covered when they're out and about, but when friends are coming up to them, there isn't that same sense of awkwardness. I think people sometimes are just afraid of death, almost as if it travels with the people who have suffered a loss.
It's catching.
Yeah.
Interesting. I saw that when I was in the Far East. When I gave my paper, another professor gave a paper on the problems of death in Buddhism. One of the things he pointed out was that after the tsunami, there was a great deal of difficulty doing anything helpful to people. Because among Buddhists, Buddhists don't want to be near people who are in contact with death. And therefore, there's no way to... We Western people have no difficulty. Well, we don't have too much difficulty with that. I shouldn't say no difficulty. We sort of step in. Buddhists don't really want to step in. They don't want to see anything. They just... It's an area of tuma. And you don't go near it. And therefore, the thing you do is you go in the other direction. And that's the only proper thing to do. It's the only proper thing to do. I hadn't thought of that, but maybe that's also, you know, there is an element of that.
The Japanese don't have an equivalent for God bless you or gesundheit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very noticeable in my lab when there's Japanese people there and somebody sneezes and everybody says something, and they don't. And so I questioned it, and they said, no, we, it's polite to say nothing.
There's also no curse word in Japanese.
The part that I was trying to figure out is the group of the three that we've been talking about, not all of those people are in that state because of a voluntariness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that I've been waiting to hear, why these three, I mean, for that regard, there is dissimilarity between them. And the only one whom I could say was voluntary, to use it that way, would be the one under the
ban.
The ban.
Right.
And then you sort of start to turn, well, the writings start to turn that around of saying it's still an attempt to bring them back to some state that will be, well, I was going to say, I'm sorry, I don't want to finish that because it's not a proper point. The mourner's involuntary. The person with leprosy is involuntary, and yet we have this other one.
Who is voluntary.
Right. And so why are all these things discussed then?
Mm-hmm.
And that to me seems like such an important distinction, almost a starting point for
mm-hmm.
me.
I could only answer that it's a starting point for you and not for them.
Right, I understand
okay.
that. That's why I'm asking.
For
why
them, voluntariness is irrelevant.
Okay.
What is relevant is, how can I say it, emotional and... existential reality, and also the
mm-hmm.
feeling of alienation from
mm-hmm.
others,
regardless
though,
of its origin.
Regardless of its origin,
right,
the origin,
origin
right? To
mm-hmm.
us, in we are so concerned about origins.
Mm-hmm.
We always think in those
mm-hmm.
terms. It's a major
mm-hmm.
problem. To deal with origins.
Well, we treat people differently because of the
correct,
origin,
correct.
Even if the state is comparable.
Correct.
And
they
we
can
often make mistakes in so doing.
I would 100% agree with you, Terry, but I just do think it's
correct.
Prevalent to our understanding.
This kind of analysis is, I might almost say, a more poetic analysis.
Yeah.
It's really poetry. It's dealing with images. It's dealing with images and feelings
and essences.
And
essences,
correct.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, the feelings are similar.
Yes.
The essences are similar, and therefore they can be equated with one another, even if one doesn't come about them in the same way.
It's even the state of being a minute that may not always have been perceived as being so voluntary by the person
no.
in that position. So,
but
I mean,
but there were more actions the person did do.
Correct.
I agree with you,
yeah,
with Jay. I didn't want to make it as...
Right.
I chose to go to see a play versus see a movie, but... There was
I think it's qualitatively a real difference between
right, there's a qualitative real difference,
yeah.
right. And the timing.
Right.
Is that's the other thing. You could argue the mourner and the leprosy person have no opportunity to have any sense of timing, of when does this happen to me in my life, at what point in my life, whereas the new death perhaps has that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't
want
to make a pure choice because I understand
yeah.
that's not the
it's
issue.
Different. Correct.
But those are very interesting points to
yep.
me
yep.
of how these customs arose.
Correct. Absolutely.
But the suggestion.
Just yes.
I have a question because I was listening to Soloveitchik, and it resonated a little bit. But I'm having trouble understanding what's the sin in Yom Kippur. We atone for our sins. Is the death a punishment for our sins? Is it a punishment for the person who's deceased? Is his interpretation
okay.
of the guilt that we feel for not having had a stronger relationship or
mm-hmm.
a modern take on something that he's observing may, at the time the laws were written, guilt for something else, and now he's transmuting it?
He's actually dealing with two things, and I wouldn't conflate them. They're two separate things. They're related, but they're not the same by any means. One is that death is in the world because of sin. That's when I said, as an aside, he's a good Orthodox rabbi.
So the tree of life and the tree of knowledge.
Correct, correct. If there had not been sin, then death would not necessarily have come into the picture.
Not particularly, but being a person.
Correct, and therefore one is reminded of that.
Of the revisited.
It revisits the primal fall of man. Every time we deal with death, we realize the sinful state of the human condition.
That I could see.
Okay, that's number one. Okay, that was his number one point.
Do you feel that the Talmud does reflect that? Is he reading something that he picked up?
It's not.
There?
Do I think that our Talmud is reflecting it, or is it reasonable? Is it a reasonable thought in light of the Talmud in general? The latter.
Yeah.
It's reasonable. It's a reasonable thought. There's much commentary on that perspective. The second thing that he is saying is that our existential condition is such that we perforce feel guilty because we do not appreciate the relationships that we have with people that we love until we don't have them.
That sounds like a very modern thought.
Yes, he's very modern. But you know, maybe it's also a very basic thought here that is part of the nature of, you know, death reminds us of the very basic things about our condition that we don't normally deal with, we don't want to deal with, we can't deal with. They are unpleasant, and this is one aspect of that, and that's one reason why we are involved in a process of expiation. Okay? Did I say that? Anybody else? Yes.
I just would like to suggest sort of the inverse of what Harry suggested, which is in terms of the covering, to think not so much about what is covered as what is left uncovered, which would be the eyes. And if the eyes are the windows to the soul, then perhaps this time, and especially when you're alone without without visitors, is a time to see clearly from into the soul, and as Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests, perhaps to
interesting
to look harder at oneself in relation to this loss.
That's an interesting thought.
Rather than at the person's life. And I just want to say one thing. I went to a Buddhist recently, a Buddhist, it's not a funeral, a memorial. And I was overwhelmed at how positive it was. It was all about the celebration of this life and this great acceptance. This was a dear friend of mine, my younger than I am. And afterwards, friends gathered, and this one friend who's not Jewish but married to a Jew said, "You know, I was just missing that aspect of the Jewish funeral of everybody just the grief, the outpouring, I wanted someone to say this was a tragedy."
That's very true. Jews, that, you know, it's very popular today, this notion, and I've seen it also among the Christians, and frankly, I would say it's in most Jewish funerals today, too.
It's a what?
Most Jewish funerals
are
positive and not negative.
Now they are.
Correct, they're now. That's what I see. That's where people have moved. It's exactly what it is. It's a celebration of life. Classically, Jews should not be that happy.
Right.
We are essentially not that happy. We are not a happy religion. We have happy things, you know. Spend a lot of time today reading about joy, and one of the Hasidic writers. But for things like death, we believe you should cry.
We are masochistic.
And of course, you should feel guilty. I mean, just the fact of what I read to you, that is so incredibly Jewish.
Yeah.
I mean, what good Buddhist would ever say anything like that? And it's an incredibly Jewish thing today to say, you know, rend your clothes, you know, it's just terrible, terrible, whatever. Life is just awful. You know.
There's another aspect connected, and that is with the death of someone close to us, we're also reminded of our own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And the more mature we are, and the closer we realize we are to that same end. And in some sense, that's a kind of because I think these the Ovel, the Menudeh, and the Metzorah have to be connected in some way. And we were talking last week about the rights or obligations of the Rabbim versus the Yachid. So in some sense, the death of an individual is a kind of a threat to the social order, in the same way that the Menudeh is by resisting the authority. And the Metzorah maybe is a public health problem. Even though they're a member of the community, they're somebody who makes the community realize, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have to find some distance between you and ourselves, mm-hmm. because if we don't, our social order will mm-hmm. is in danger of collapsing from disease, from rejection of the social contract, or from... If you feel your days are limited,
mm-hmm. the despair.
Days were a lot more limited.
Right.
Why do I have to do all of this stuff? I got to go to shul. I got to daven 3 times a day. I got to give so much stock.
Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. I mean, there is no social order, really. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
So
if death can destroy it all.
Kind of a threat to the society.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Did Maimonides say anything about this custom? Because he was earlier than. In the
I don't remember. I assume that Maimonides, we could look it up and take a look and see. Since he was a Sephardi, and Rabbi Yosef would reflect what Rabbi Yosef Karo says, so I'm sure that he would have done it, but what I don't know, I didn't look at Maimonides to see whether he describes exactly what they did, what the custom was, that I don't know. Very good.
Thank
to be continued.
So, I'm so old.